It wasn't all that long ago that the idea of robotic drones patrolling the skies would have seemed like the stuff of science fiction, but as you know, today it's a reality. The next frontier, especially for the military, may be cyborg animals. In fact, there have been a number of stunning breakthroughs in that research in recent years where scientists have been able to hack the central nervous systems of animals and bend their behaviors to their will. Remote-controlled rats scurrying over disaster sites and Pentagon-bred beetles equipped with special sensors may not be all that far off. Joining us now is Emily Anthes, author of Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. It's published by Scientific American, Farah Straus and Giroux, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, also known as DARPA, has expressed great interest in insect cyborgs. Why would the military want to develop a unit of controllable flying insects?
Well, as you mentioned, the military is very interested in drones. And as they develop this technology, they get more and more interested in tiny drones, drones that might be inobtrusive or that can essentially sneak into hostile territories and conduct surveillance. The problem is that it's really hard to engineer one of these tiny drones from scratch. The dynamics of flight change when you get very small, and it's also hard to power these crafts. They require some sort of battery, and if you have a battery that's powerful enough to keep drones aloft a long time, it tends to be too heavy for these very light aircraft. So a few years ago, in 2006, actually, DARPA realized that perhaps they could piggyback on insects. Insects, of course, power themselves and already know how to fly. So the idea was if you could just figure out a way to control their movements, you would suddenly have your tiny flying drone.
But most insects are fairly small. What kind of equipment could they carry?
That's a good question. So far, researchers have been using some of the bigger insects, like beetles, which can carry bigger payloads, but they would need to develop miniaturized surveillance equipment. In some ways, that might be an easier task than developing tiny little batteries. Electronics are shrinking rapidly, so it's certainly possible.
You write that DARPA's call for controllable insects launched a grand science fair. I'm assuming these kinds of projects require a convergence of neurology, entomology, and computers. Are there people who specialize in all three?
Not necessarily. And in fact, one of the scientists I profile is an engineer, and so he was an expert at building little tiny parts, but he knew nothing about insect biology. So he told me he sort of had to take a crash course in insect biology to figure out where to put the electrodes.
That's Michel Maharbis?
That's right.
He's an engineer at UC Berkeley, and he and his team were able to build a remote-controlled flower beetle.
That's right.
How was he able to do that?
It requires a couple of different steps. The first thing they wanted to do was figure out how to control its flight to just make it take off and land. And this they figured out they could do by threading wires into a part of the beetle's brain at the base of the optic lobe. And it turns out that part of the brain controls basic flight motions. So if they send an electronic pulse to that part of the brain, the beetle suddenly takes off and starts flying. A different pulse to the same region, and the beetle will stop flying. It's such a dramatic effect that the beetle will just instantly fall out of the air. And then to get some control over the direction of its movements, they threaded additional wires into the base of the beetle's wings. So they could stimulate the right wing, for instance, to start beating much more rapidly. And when that happened, the beetle would naturally turn to the left and vice versa.
So they can control beetle flight pretty well.
Yes and no. It's still a bit of a crude system, so they can sort of steer it in different directions. But ultimately, to be useful, they want to control these beetles much more precisely. So to tell it to turn not just to the left, but 20 degrees to the left, for instance.
Aren't there many beetle species, perhaps more than any other insect? Why did they choose flower beetles?
They actually tried a couple different beetles, and they ended up with flower beetles partly because they are so big and sturdy. They thought it would be a good place to start. It's easier to do the operations to get the wires in, and conceivably they could carry heavier equipment. But now that they've done this with flower beetles, they are looking to miniaturize it. Maharbi has actually told me that he'd like to develop a remote-controlled fly, which would, of course, be much, much smaller.
Flies are teeny, but I was wondering whether the insect would resist some of this. After all, it may have its own ideas of where it wants to go.
Yeah, that's a good question. From what we can tell so far, they don't resist the basic controls we have, partly because they're muscular. They actually force the muscles to start contracting in a certain way. There are other kinds of insect cyborgs that are more about training than about forcing muscles to fire, and those it's easier for the animal to sort of disobey the commands, if you will.
Do we know if the beetles experience any pain or discomfort having these wires stuck into their brains?
Well, we actually don't know whether invertebrates like that experience pain, period. It's sort of an unknown, but the researchers assume that they do, so they take some precautions. They anesthetize the insects, for instance, when they do the actual surgeries to implant the wires. It's not really clear what the beetle's experience is, though, once it wakes up and it's being steered around.
So we have this beetle that we're making move straight ahead, then go to the left, then go to the right, and then what is it doing? Is it carrying a little bomb, or is it carrying a microphone?
Right now, nothing. So right now, scientists have really just been focused on getting the remote control aspects down. But yes, the idea is that you could put any sort of surveillance equipment on it. There has not been any mention of weaponizing these beetles, so I haven't seen any proposals to put bombs on them. But one interesting proposal is you could put maybe a chemical sensor on their backs that is able to detect traces of explosives. So perhaps you could steer this beetle into an abandoned building in a military zone, and it could send you back information letting you know whether there are any bombs in the building.
Isn't research also being done into implanting cybernetic devices into insects while they're in the pupa phase of their lives?
That's right, and that's one of the next phases, because insects go through this remarkable morphogenesis where the larvae wrap themselves up in cocoons or shells and they develop their adult bodies. And so researchers realized that if they implant the electronics during this phase while the insects are in a cocoon, then the adult insect's body will actually build itself around the implant. So it gives you a much more permanent interface.
And it becomes part of the animal from the moment, or the insect from the moment of birth.
Right, from the moment it hatches as an adult.
Now, didn't the CIA experiment with using animals for intelligence in the 60s? There was an Operation Acoustic Kitty, wasn't there?
It did. It was not a very successful experiment, to put it mildly. The idea was similar in some ways. The researchers at the CIA wanted to essentially turn a cat into a spy, so they actually implanted some electronics equipment in the cat's body, and the idea was maybe the cat could go wander into a windowsill in a Soviet compound and record whatever conversations were taking place there and send them back. But it ended dramatically when, on its first field run, the cat was run over by a taxi. So that was the end of the Acoustic Kitty project.
Well, you can't trust those taxi cabs when you're trying to do spying. Emily Anthes is a journalist whose work has appeared in Wired, Scientific American, Psychology Today, Slate, the Boston Globe, and other publications. Her book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts, is published by Scientific American / Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Researchers at SUNY have been working on sending electrical signals into rodent skulls. Is the basic principle similar to what they have been doing with the beetles' brains?
It's similar, but it is a bit different. So with the beetles, as I mentioned, the scientists are actually forcing the animal's muscles to contract in a certain way to move. The rodents rely more on training. So what the scientists do is they'll send stimulation, say, to the right side of the rodent's face. They make it feel as though the rodent's whiskers are being stroked. And then through a series of training sessions, they teach the rodents to turn in the correct direction.
And the rodents are rats and mice, or are there preferred rodents for these experiments?
I believe it's only been rats so far, though you could conceivably do the exact same thing with mice.
What kinds of behaviors are we now able to elicit in rats through this kind of technology? So we get them to go to the left, to the right. Are we putting microphones in them as well?
We are not. I don't believe the rats have been proposed as surveillance gatherers. There are other ideas for how the rats could be used. One potential, for instance, might be to use them to detect mines. Because the animals are too light to set mines off with their own body weight, you could sort of steer them through a field and use, again, chemical sensors that perhaps can detect the signatures of explosives used in mines. And maybe in this way you could sort of map a minefield.
As long as there are no taxicabs in the area.
Exactly.
In your book, I came across an emerging field I've never heard of. What is optogenetics?
It's a really hot new field. It's very young, but it's growing rapidly. So the examples we've been talking about mostly involve using electronics and electrical stimulation to manipulate an animal's nervous system. Optogenetics is an entirely different model. Scientists have figured out how to control neurons and brain cells with just flashes of light instead of pulses of electricity. And it's a two-part process. The first step is to genetically engineer a mouse or a rat whose brains respond to light. And then you can, say, put a helmet on these rodents that flash different LED lights. And when the lights go off, it forces neurons to fire, and the mice behave in certain ways.
But don't they also use viruses to inject plant genes for light sensitivity into the brains of these mice?
Right. So that's the genetic engineering phase. They take these genes that are found in plants or algae and make those organisms responsive to light. And they
mean photosynthesis.
Right. Or other kinds of, you know, moving in the direction of light, various responses to light.
So what?
Go ahead.
No.
They wrap these genes in a virus, essentially, and inject it into, say, a mouse brain. Viruses, of course, are very, very good at invading cells. That's what they do. So they will invade the brain cells of a mouse, and when they do that, they dump this light-responsive gene into the neurons, and the neurons, in some cases, incorporate the gene into their own cells, and suddenly they're responsive to light as well.
So is it optogenetics thought of as being less invasive than other methods of controlling animals?
I'm not sure that's true. It's just a new method and new set of techniques. In theory, it might allow better precision because you can also control which neurons become responsive to light. So you can make certain neurons fire when they are exposed to blue light, for instance, and maybe make other neurons go silent when they're exposed to orange light. So you can layer all these effects on top of one another.
And you can make them aggressive, you can make them sleepy, you can do all sorts of different things
right
through this kind of control. Do they pass it on to their offspring?
They do not, because these changes aren't in the germline. They're not in the reproductive cells.
You write that these new technologies are helping us create new beasts of burden. How different are these emerging technologies from what we've traditionally done with animals? I mean, making donkeys do our bidding, or horses, or elephants, or camels.
They're definitely part and parcel of what we've been doing for centuries, but in some cases, like with the beetles, it's definitely a new level of control. With training, animals at least still have some choice. They can choose to obey or disobey the commands. But in some of these cyborg animals, those choices don't exist. We are making the choices for the animals and forcing their bodies to act in certain ways. So in that way, you can certainly say a more extreme type of intervention.
And I'd also guess that people are okay with using beetles like this, but not necessarily the family dog or a horse.
That's right. And one of the researchers I talked to who made the beetle said he thinks one reason he hasn't gotten much hate mail is because people don't care very much about insects. And then he adds that it's a shame because he does. But there's definitely a species effect in play. It would be much more unsettling to see, I think, pets controlled this way than an insect, which is already sort of a sci-fi looking creature.
Are there ethicists talking about these sorts of things?
Absolutely, and the questions are very much open. These technologies are so new that I haven't really seen a consensus emerge. And to their credit, the scientists doing this work are also very much engaged in these discussions. They know that what they're doing raises new questions and that not everyone will agree with it. And from what I've seen, they're very happy to engage in those conversations.
Now, is this technology going to be available to us all eventually? I was reading about how one of the approaches that we're now having to rodent infestation is to sterilize females as a way of keeping down their populations in parks rather than poisoning them and trying some of the other methods in the past. Could we wind up seeing this on a non-military level?
I think it's certainly possible. Once you have the technology, it can be used in all sorts of ways. There are some civilian applications that have already been proposed. One of the most common ones is maybe to use these animals as search and rescue animals. Perhaps they could replace the dogs that are used now. You could steer these kinds of beetles or rats through rubble after an earthquake and maybe use them to find human survivors. So the possibilities are really almost limitless.
Isn't there something called RoboRoach?
There is. So RoboRoach is actually available to the public. It sells for $100 online. A company called Backyard Brains sells it, and it's a very similar kind of approach. It's a kit that gives you all you need to make a remote-controlled cockroach, and it's a little bit more crude than what scientists have done, but the principles are the same. You can steer the roach to the left and the right and essentially take over its movement.
Is this research helping us understand human neurology?
Absolutely, especially some of the optogenetics work. The idea is that if you selectively activate a few neurons or silence them, and the mouse suddenly falls asleep, for instance, or suddenly gets aggressive, it gives you a really good clue about what that neural circuit's function is. And so it has big potential for basic research and helping us just untangle what different parts of the brain do.
But let's take some of these issues to their possible conclusions. Would it be possible someday to use similar methods of neurological control on humans, creating a perhaps more effective Manchurian candidate?
I think there's no reason that's impossible technologically. Whether we'll actually see that happen and whether society will let this technology go that far is less clear. But there are some applications that are already being discussed for more, I guess, less loaded applications for therapies for brain diseases and dysfunctions. So perhaps you can use electrodes or the tools of optogenetics to turn different brain circuits on and off that are involved in epilepsy, for instance. So there is a therapeutic potential as well.
And people who perhaps have lost the use of an arm might be able to regain that through this sort of thing?
Exactly, a potential for bionic limbs and all sorts of that stuff.
Have you been hearing, not you, because you're not one of the scientists, but have we been hearing from groups like PETA and other animal rights groups expressing concerns about this kind of research?
You know, I haven't heard PETA address this issue directly, but these scientists certainly get emails from the general public, and any stories about these advances are usually overrun with comments in the comments section about people making all sorts of objections, which are totally understandable. So there are arguments that this is unfair to the animal, that it's inhumane, that it turns living creatures into objects that are being used merely for our own purposes, there are some legitimate questions about this technology.
But how hypothetical is this and how realistic is it? Are we going to see a beetle army sometime in the near future?
Near future, probably not. As I mentioned, our control is still pretty crude, and scientists also haven't dealt with the surveillance equipment problem. So if we actually want to put these beetles out there, we need to design and attach the right sensors or cameras or microphones. So there's a ways to go. But I'd be surprised if we don't see them in some capacity over the next few decades, whether that's military or search and rescue or something more educational. I think we'll be seeing more of these bugs out there.
And what about the rats and mice? I can imagine a situation where one of these rats or mice winds up in a backyard and just a regular cat finds it and is totally confused.
That would be an interesting sight to see. I think the focus has moved a little bit from some of the rats and mice to the insects, partly because their nervous systems seem to be easier to take control of, and also perhaps because the ethical questions seem to be less loaded when you're dealing with insects. I'm not sure the rats and the mice will ever make it out of the laboratory.
Emily Anthes's book, her name is spelled A-N-T-H-E-S, is Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. It is published by Scientific American, Farrah Straus and Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.